happy to be here. I had this giddy feeling as I pulled into the parking lot. It's just a great joy. I miss very much the Skagit Valley, and I miss this community, and I'm so happy to see you here and to know that this community is still here. Our reading this morning is from a book that I claim as my favorite book of the year, and I started reading it in 2018, and I'm still continuing to pick it up. It's called the author's Parker Palmer. Some of you may know his work, but this one is Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit. In this book, Parker Palmer gives voice to a yearning for a politic that honors the human spirit. And in studying it, I have more courage to stand in the public sphere and to hold life's political tensions consciously. I believe it's what is at stake today is our common future and the vitality of the fragile democracy we inherited, and in some ways have neglected at our peril. The book affirms what we as citizens can do that will matter, and how much depends on what we do. Parker advocates accountability, compassion, fierce reality, and congregations committed to our collective well-being. It has influenced all of my sermon. So I've chosen just a few excerpts from the book to share with you. Habits of the heart are deeply ingrained ways of seeing, being, and responding to life that involve our minds, our emotions, our self-images, our concepts of meaning and purpose in life. I believe that these five taken together are critical to sustaining a democracy. Ecologists, economists, ethicists, philosophers of science, and religious and secular leaders have all given voice to the idea that we are all in this together. Despite our illusions of individualism and national superiority, we humans are a profoundly interconnected species, entwined with one another and with all forms of life. As the global economic and ecological crisis reveal in frightening and vivid detail, we must embrace the simple fact that we are dependent on and accountable to one another, and that includes the stranger, the alien other. At the same time, we must save this notion of interdependence from the idealistic excesses that make it an impossible dream. In the end, the challenge faced by adherents of every tradition of faith or reason is the same one we face in our public lives: to let the stranger and things we find strange be who and what they are, allowing them to open us to the vexing and enlivening mysteries we find within and around us. Within us is a yearning for something better than divisiveness, toxicity, passivity, powerlessness, and selling our democratic inheritance to the highest bidder. Within us is the courage to partner that yearning, to hold life's tensions consciously, faithfully, and well until they break us open. The broken, open heart is a source of power as well as compassion, the power to bring down whatever diminishes us and rise up whatever serves us well. We can access and deploy that power by doing what every great social movement has ever done: put time, skill, and energy into the education and mobilization of the powers of the heart. So ends our reading. My sermon is politics, patriotism, and our UU faith. And it is a time of thinking about patriotism as we are dealing with a Memorial Day weekend. I understand patriotism to be the love and devotion to our country. And we are at this weekend remembering the people who died while serving in the country's armed services, as well as remembering our troops that are serving today and their military families. Memorial Day originated following the Civil War, but this holiday wasn't officially declared by the federal government until 1966 in Waterloo, New York, a place I lived 10 miles from till I was 17. And it involves, as a holiday does, getting together with friends, acknowledging our military with parades and marching bands, marching personnel, visiting cemeteries, and unofficially as well marks the beginning of summer. But what does it mean to be a patriot? I have wrestled with that over the last few years. William Sloan Coffin said that there really are three kinds of patriots: two bad and one good. The bad, he says, are the uncritical lovers of America democracy. And secondly, the bad are the loveless critics of democracy. His good patriot is the patriots that carrying on like a lover's quarrel with their country. The patriot that carries on like a lover's quarrel with their country. I have often felt that I was quarreling with my country. It started in 1964 for me, protesting the war, and it's continued as I've walked with Me Too movements and I've protested the Gulf War. I remember protesting. I remember being very angry as a patriot. And it wasn't until 10 years ago that I really could stand favorably towards my country and feel very good about being an American. I was in a foreign country where I had a backpack on and also a small purse over my shoulder, which was snapped off my shoulder by two young boys and carted off at a great run because I tried to chase them and they outchased me. And it had everything in it: passport, money, my ticket home, everything. Everything. So I tried to find someone who spoke English. I begged my way through various taxis that I approached to try to take me to the American Embassy. Once I arrived at the embassy, there were three circles of guards. First, guards of the native country I was in. Second, guards of American soldiers in uniform. And then a third guard that was in a very strong, completely contained booth. And in each time I told my story, yes, I'm here and this is who I am and I need some help and I have nothing and I don't even have coins, I have no money, going through it. And then I was allowed, finally, after these layers, to go to the front door of the embassy, which opened grandly, was four doors, and there stood this tall, very handsome, well-uniformed young man who saluted me and said, "Welcome to America." At which point, I sat down and cried. I hadn't cried up till then. I was just angry. And I felt tremendous relief. That was a changing point for me in terms of my own patriotism. Within 3 hours, I had cash and a new passport. So it was a very illuminating experience. So I stand before you as an American patriot and make no excuse for it. And as we think about this weekend, we might ask ourselves as citizens of this democracy how we can manage to be courageous and committed to our present democracy. Now, I've never preached about politics before. I've avoided it. But I feel compelled today. We are so involved in it. It's a daily drama unfolding each day in a different way. It's easy to get submerged in it, partly because you can't get away from it. So for a time now, we citizens have been really struggling, have been having trouble talking across our lines of difference about the common good. So much trouble that some of us doubt the very concept of a common good and doubt that it can be possible to have a common good. In our government today, politicians don't differ with each other honestly, but they do demonize each other easily. It's seductive to gather around like-minded people and share like-minded views. But regardless of one's political view, be it right, left, or center, we need to look at our current situation honestly and find ways to handle it. And it does take courage. Now, I would make a guess that the majority of you sitting here today did not vote for our current president. I do not want to alienate anyone here that did, and I don't want to also be critical or insult your support of him if you are presently supporting him. And I don't want to talk about him. Him is not in the room, so I'm not going to talk about him. The divide between our political parties is at an all-time high. All sides of the divide should not tolerate this situation. And some, like a student in my yoga class last week who shouted out, "I'm terrified by it," are very frightened. There are many young people in particular in their 20s and 30s that I've talked with that are very frightened. So how do we find a way to make good from this situation? Can we move from fear and grief and anger towards new possibilities in the political arena? How can we find something meaningful for ourselves and something helpful to others within our political model of democracy? I believe justice cannot depend on just the good of government at this time. We all want politics to be a cloth we can all be proud of, woven with a warp of compassion and the weft of justice. And that goal can be strongly influenced by looking at our faith's connection, our Unitarian Universalist connection to our present political situation. First, some understanding about how democracy works in our faith. Our history shows a continual striving for individual freedom. Our church community is voluntary. No one is required to be here. There is no authoritative theology we must abide by. We create our own meaning making. We are the meaning makers. For example, I call myself a Buhai. I have a Buddhist meditation practice. That's the BU. A Unitarian Universalist chosen denominational faith, that's the UU, and a Hindu yoga practice. So Buhai personhood really works for me. I can put that together comfortably. Reverends John Buren's and Forrester Church's great little book, which you have a copy of here in your library, because I remember I gave it to you, is a chosen faith. Chosen. This makes our liberal faith very clear. Choice is key in understanding the freedom we have to choose a spiritual belief system that feels right to us. And Rosemary's opening words said just that. Hooray. I hear that so infrequently in the churches I attend. Thank you. People have been persecuted in the past and are persecuted still today for going against authoritative religion. But we come from a long line of free thinkers, courageous pioneers, creative seekers doing their best for religious freedom. So yes, ours is a freely chosen faith without doctrine, yet it asks of us faith with involvement with our seven principles. So here's the teacher in me, because I'm passionate about these principles, but I'm going to talk about these a little for you in case you've forgotten some of them. I think the first principle is the umbrella for all others. We respect the inherent worth and dignity of all people. And as well, I think our seventh principle holds all the others up. This is the one that reminds us that we are part of an interdependent web of life. We all share that together. We respect the inherent worth and dignity, and we share an interconnectedness. But this morning, I want us to think about and focus on our fifth principle, one that gets a little lost among the seven. We promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. Now, we might wonder how this one is a religious issue and how it came to be one of the seven. What does the right of conscience have to do with how our church community is ruled? And what has the democratic rule of and for the people, which allows people to rule themselves, what does that really promote? So looking first at the democratic process. It means the democratic rule. It is a way to organize. It allows us to have the majority, have the control, to govern most of the time. Our elected boards, and if there is a minister, the minister collaborates with this. They collaborate in governance. And as members of this democratic process, we agree to this. And it follows that within the church community, each child, youth, and adult will be well respected, will have a voice, and have a conscience. We each try to live by and represent our principles and the values specified in those principles. We agree to abide by what the majority of our members' free liberal religious choices are. Well, we do it most of the time. Sometimes we argue about the decisions from the board, even without the collaboration of the minister. But we try to move towards consensus. We understand it is not a perfect system, this democratic way of functioning, and we're not perfect human beings. But in all of the six churches I have served, folks try their best to let governance work. Let the majority rule. And if there's patience and willingness, many try to work towards consensus. For example, accepting a decision that is not a personal choice helps work towards consensus. We know that history as well has proven that the majority can be wrong. Some of our Unitarian Universalist history with racism is an illustration of some of the wrongs that we have made. The majority is not the people. It's the largest percentage of the people. And we are, as a denomination, making great strides in trying to correct some of what we've done in the past around racism. Unitarian Universalism is a free-thinking liberal religion that is guided by our shared values, not a specific dogma or creed. This gives each of us the opportunity, as well as the challenge, to determine our own personal beliefs based upon conscience and experience. Remembering that the very essence of UUism is an emphasis on the worth and value of every person and the interconnectedness of all, that one in seven. But back to the fifth principle, looking specifically at right of conscience. Most religions in the world, and I've studied them all, I've taught them all, they all have some form of a golden rule, which is treat others as you would like them to treat you. As well, in looking at humanist, secular humanism, I have been led to understand that even with secular humanists, there is an understanding of conscience, that the person's habits that are allowed to be held is considered important rationally to look at without coming undone, without being bothered. That's what a secular humanist does. For us, it is our worth and dignity being promoted for all. It's our Jiminy Cricket voice that reminds us to foster the well-being of all and reminds us of the worth of all. It's what the Buddhists call the Buddha nature. It's what helps us to move towards good and helps us to promote justice and compassion in our lives and in the world as we go about manifesting our inherent worth and dignity. Are you following me here as you use? I mean, are you getting it? Are you faith is working with conscience and the golden rule? Okay, so if we believe each person has inherent worth and dignity, that no one is more worthy than another without privilege, it makes sense that each person in a religious community is responsible for the well-being of every other person, and all are equally responsible. Therefore, we are all responsible and should participate in governing. We have a participatory role in fellowship life, in congregational life. It's necessary. And we then promote the right to treat others as you would like them to treat you. This fifth principle places us face to face with the absolute need for compassion as well as love. It is central to our religion, and it is central to America today. Our principle of compassion makes me very glad. It helps me understand the heartfelt part of our denomination. Karen Armstrong, one of my great heroines, in her well-known Charter of Compassion, explains it beautifully. The principle of compassion lies at the heart of all religious, ethical, and spiritual traditions, calling us to treat all others as we would wish to be treated ourselves. Compassion impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and put another there, and to honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody without exception with absolute justice, equity, and respect. That includes knowing each other's stories, listening to each other's stories, and sharing each other's stories, exemplified by some of the stories you shared this morning in your joys and your sorrows. It's knowing the stories and telling our stories that makes it less possible to see that person as an enemy, or maybe that person is too divisive for me to connect with. All the world's faiths insist that true spirituality must be expressed in practical compassion, the ability to feel with the other, offering our hearts to the other. Perhaps some of you here have tried to talk with family members or neighbors or friends in a way that is respectful and honoring. Now, I am almost certain that none of us here this morning lacks for pain that cries out for a political change only love can offer. We each are imperfect and broken beings. We each have known loss, sadness, and confusion. The genius of our hearts lies in its capacity to use these experiences to generate insight, energy, and new life. It's holding these tensions as we need to hold them and understand them, and then letting them go and moving towards a lightness, a sharing. According to the best estimates, 1/3 of people in this country, at least 1/3, attend a religious body or community 1 or 2 times a month. This is good potential to make major contributions to our political arena. And Parker emphasizes how important it is for churches and fellowships to do just that. It also affirms the best of humanity and even makes it possible to bring social and sacred beliefs next to each other and sit with each other. Look here what you are continuing to create in this fellowship. It's a beautiful setting. It's a wonderful place. It's filled with wonderful sounds and music, competent administration, wonderful leaders who hold it together year and year and year after year. You are self-governing. You've done a wonderful job. And because you don't have a minister, you are very clued in to wondering at different times where the authority lies and who's in charge. And I brought with me something this morning that reminds me of this fellowship, but also I absolutely adore. Claire, I don't know how long it's been since you've seen this print, but this is Claire Phillips' print, and it's called Who's in Charge Here? And it's just brilliant. It's wonderful, because according to Palmer, the more fellowships, churches, and gathering places of religious belief understand that it has to be mutual. It has to be decided on democratically. It has to be taken on responsibly by every person involved in the community.
I'm going to place this here so you can look at it better after the service ends.
We'll remember that for the summer sign-up sheet.
It's a wonderful sheet. Here in this fellowship, there is a belief in the power of the human heart. Here in this fellowship, there's a belief in values and ideas, commitment and vision, understanding that our heart's power is within us as well as outside us. But we know that we're not giving all that power outside of ourselves. We understand that as Unitarian Universalists. Here you believe in the common good. You don't just sit back and watch. You know that in this community you can't always have things go your personal choice way, but you are able to be together in a loving and compromising way. And this community is worth it. You're walking your spiritual path together. And this community is wonderfully available to many others. In this community, you help each other find a common voice that listens openly and responds reflectively, as well as responsibly, as well as respectfully. In order to keep our politics not only survive at this time, but thrive in 2019, I invite you to challenge yourselves just a little further, to think of yourselves as pilgrims. I understand pilgrim as one who embarks on a quest for something you know is sacred, carrying on a lover's quarrel with our democracy. Perhaps it's intentionally opening your door and hearts to the other, to the stranger, inviting perhaps more diversity than you have right now, inviting in people or persons that may be alien or unsettling as you aim to appreciate otherness. Let's agree to disagree with others. It's seductive to be with like-minded people all the time, but I don't believe it's productive. Walking with each other as pilgrims means more than pledging or serving on committees. It means finding your own voice on matters of faith and life and compassionate living, questing to be one nation, indivisible, trusting our principles and honoring the sources from which we've gleaned these principles to guide us as we all try to do this. Here, giving life to our values is encouraged. Working to emulate compassion and respect and justice offers us the opportunity to make the world better for the sake of our children. It's a dynamic faith community that can recognize its shortcomings and continue to learn from them and each other. We recognize that we have a responsibility in this faith to others outside these walls. Our principles demand this of us. Another one of my heroines is Maureen Wright Alderman, and she wrote, "Democracy is not a spectator sport. You just need to be a flea against injustice. Enough committed fleas biting strategically can make even the biggest dog uncomfortable and transform even the biggest nation." We can each be fleas biting. We can each be warriors for democracy. Our faith is about advancing lives lived more abundantly, more generously, more givingly, more courageously, more compassionately. And at wounded times in history, which I believe this is a wounded time in our history, more daringly. Unitarian Universalism has a history of being daring and effecting change. There have been martyrs that have been burned at the stake for their daring. I am not advocating martyrdom. I am suggesting the best we can do now is to produce an effect, to affect the political conditions of the day. Even a small group of people can do just that. I believe we all can make contributions to politics today. I am trying very hard to be hopeful. Philosopher David Oren said, "Hope is a verb with its shirt sleeves rolled up." So I'm going to continue to roll up my shirt sleeves. I invite you to do the same. And you know I had to bring the word hope up at this sermon because it's key to my own spiritual understanding. Getting to work with our fifth principle in mind can sustain us at this time. Liberal politics has lost some battles and is losing some battles. But liberal religion has not. So we regroup, we revise strategy, we retreat when we need to take care of ourselves, and then we can redouble our efforts. Take inspiration for those pilgrims that have come before us. Stand together, walk together, talk together, march together, cry together, pray together with all those who love life and love life lived abundantly. I commend you on all your efforts. I applaud this beautiful, beautiful gathering and its beautiful space. It is really a sacred space. So now let's sing together, Sally, our final hymn, number 318. I admit this is one of my favorites. Please stand if you're willing and able.
We are
which binds our hearts and points us on our way. I want to offer us some closing words. Rather than a benediction, I want to offer a metta meditation. Metta stands for loving kindness. And the meditation is this: may all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings be safe and free. May all beings be able to care for themselves with ease and with joy. Amen.